This is unbelievable. College basketball. Incredible.
You know they're going to try to run backdoor play if they can get it.
Under 10. Backdoor.
Goes out. Here's Davis. Davis for the win. He's got it. Princeton is going to the NCAA tournament.
I've met so many people in basketball in my life, but none that have had as fascinating a journey as Brian Taylor, and no one who is smarter, more passionate about basketball, education, giving back, service, teaching. Brian's a really, really interesting guy, and you can hear some of that for yourself here now. Brian, you're a 1969 graduate of Perth Amboy. You then attended Princeton, played in the NBA, the ABA first, excuse me, the end of the NBA. And then life after basketball has been very interesting too. But let's start in Perth. You know, tell me about growing up in Perth Amboy and about your family.
Yes, it's very interesting upbringing for me. And first of all, thank you for having me today, Coach.
Oh, glad you're here.
I love growing up in Perth Amboy. Just being back in New Jersey over the last couple of months, my friends and I always talk about what it was like growing up in Perth Amboy, and one of the things that stands out for us as we discuss it right now was the tremendous diversity that we all experienced growing up, all different nationalities, different races, and how much we got along and how special it was growing up in a place like Perth Amboy.
Why was that, Brian? Like, why was it?
I think it's because of the history of a place like Perth Amboy. Perth Amboy is a historic city that drew a lot of different nationalities to this sort of like a little Mecca. It's a beautiful place. It's got a beautiful waterfront. Back in the day, it was known for its beaches, a nice little beach area down on the waterfront, beautiful historic buildings. It was just a draw around the world. As you can see, even today, there's been a lot of different ethnic groups that live in Perth Amboy today. But growing up in Perth Amboy back in the day was something very, very special because of the diversity and because of the people. A lot of support even from a young age. And I was one of the fortunate ones that grew up with a fabulous family support. Both my mother and father are hard workers. My mom was a domestic. She worked in someone's house and made sure it was beautiful. And my father was a laborer. He worked at Copper Works, and they were there.
Was that in Perth?
That was in Perth Amboy, yeah. Both of them worked in Perth Amboy, very close to where we grew up in Delaney Homes, is known as the Projects. It was built in, when I was born, back in 1950-51. It was a public housing, and we were fortunate. We were one of the first families to move into it. And so growing up in the Projects and growing up in Delaney Homes, there were a lot of families in this complex, and a lot of kids my age, and sports was really a big thing. Believe it or not, my first love was not basketball nor football. My first love was baseball.
Really?
And so it was very interesting as a 6 years old bat boy for my brother, Bruce.
Bruce, playing, also a terrific athlete like you, right? Ended Bruce up playing for the 49ers.
Yeah, Bruce is Hall of Fame, collegiate Hall of Fame, both in baseball and in football. And I couldn't beat him out in basketball. We played together. I was a freshman, and he was a senior. And I thought I had the starting job over him. But the only reason the coach started me is because he was still hurt from football. And when he returned, I went to the bench. But I was an important sixth man on that team. So just special growing up in Perth Amboy because of the athletics as well as the social element of a place like historic Perth Amboy. And like I said, baseball at 6 years old was my first love.
Yeah.
Playing on the Italian Triple League Club.
The Italian Triple League.
The Italian Triple League Club. And what was so special about it is they had a club within Perth Amboy. So we would always go over to Perth Amboy and eat that Italian food. So as to today, I still love Italian food, the chicken parmesan. And, you know, not so much the pasta, but I love chicken parmesan. So the Italian Triple League Club, playing baseball, knocking the ball out of the park. That was my first love. And then football became something that was very, very exciting, even before basketball, because my brother was a tremendous football player. And my father, Stephen Taylor, was a semi-pro football player. And I can remember we used to play at the Rec, which was the facility that was built for us in the projects. And my dad would always get on my case because we would love to go outside of the Rec, which they had a little field outside of the Rec, and play tackle football. And I would always go home bruised up, and my dad was like, man, you can't be playing tackle football with no supervision. Somebody's going to get hurt. And we would always laugh at him and say, yeah, Dad. But what it did is it just made me a lot tougher for basketball. Mm-hmm. And I started playing basketball probably as my third sport at the Rec. And then there was another park that was a congregation for everybody all over Perth Amboy called Washington Park. Within walking distance of the projects. And what was so interesting, I had a conversation with one of my old coaches who lived in this nice area of Perth Amboy, and we had to walk through this nice area of Perth Amboy to get to Washington Park coming from the projects. And they had all the beautiful fruit trees, the peaches and the apples. And people always remember us walking through that area because the coach was saying, I always get mad at you guys because I always heard that ball bouncing going through my community. So a very special place. I still love it to this day. Mm-hmm. And that's Perth Amboy.
Yeah. And was there somebody in particular at the Rec that recognized in you and your brother that, you know, and you know, basketball or football or a coach or a figure in that area that was said, you know, I want you to come here and get involved as you got older?
You know what? It was really not in the Rec that we were recognized so much for our athletic ability because there were so many talented kids growing up in the projects. I think it was more when we got to middle school, the middle school time where we had a very strict physical education teacher, we called him Mr. Osislo. And he was very, very dogmatic and mean, we thought, but he was very strict, very disciplined, that recognized that we were very talented and that he wanted to make sure that we were fundamentally sound and good leaders. We were part of his leadership club. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Osislo was the beginning of the support network that we had going forward.
This is a recurring theme in your life, that we'll get to in a minute.
Definitely.
The concept of leadership.
Yes.
Something that's been very important to you. Brian, if you could, tell me about your parents. Because obviously, talented, very good player. I mean, you're a star quarterback, very good basketball player as well. But, you know, where did the emphasis on education come from?
I think the emphasis came on education just throughout the family. Not so much... I could say this specifically to my parents, but to my older brother it was important, and to my sister it was important. It was just a sort of a family tradition and a community. I had a great teacher in elementary school, Mr. Balint. As a matter of fact, I got a call from him about a year ago. It really surprised me. And he was saying, guess who's my neighbor? I'm like, I have no idea, coach. I haven't talked to you in... 35, 40 years. It's in middle school, 7th and 8th grade. Great teacher, one of my favorite teachers of all time. And he said, my neighbor is Ted Menakis. And that was our quarterback. That was our playmaker on the Princeton basketball team. And he had a big influence on me because he taught me how to be a really good student. His outlines were just impeccable. I mean, they were so neat. He put them on the board. He said, just taught me how to do outline. And if I studied my outline, I was going to be able to ace his courses. And so those type of influences early in life made a big difference in my journey. My coaches were tremendous. My baseball coach, like I said, who had a big influence on me, Mr. Durazmi is his name. At 6 years old, allowed me to be the bat boy for my big brother, Bruce, on the Italian Tripoli Club. It was also a big influence for me in terms of understanding that I loved the game and I could be a part of the game even though I wasn't on the team. And so those type of relationships really had a big impact on me growing up.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the ideal way to grow up in a lot of ways. You know, you get a diverse area where being diverse not only, you know, ethnically, but also educationally and athletically, right?
Yeah, like, and so much love. The community was, had so much love. Everywhere we turned, we had love. My mom was just a loving person who was called mom by my friends and all of our acquaintances when they met her. They just knew that there was this attraction that she had, that she was just such a loving person.
And this, for those of us that know you, this has been a big part of who you are for, you know, people that really know you is love, right?
Yes.
Like giving back. And
definitely.
Is,
it's a, something that I'm very, very proud of is that as a principal, as a director, as executive director of the schools that I helped establish, when I walked into the classrooms where I walked in, on campus, the kids would run up to my, you know, my knees and my waist. And even though we know it's a tough time in terms of hugging people, there were always a lot of hugs that came, you know, my way, because they knew that that there was unconditional love for the kids. And, of course, that was returned for me. And also my dad. My dad was a Navy seaman, which means discipline.
Mm-hmm.
Very strict, very quiet man. Big man, we call him Big Steve, you know, 6'2", he's probably at the time, before he learned how to diet, it's probably about 260, 6'2", 260, Big Steve, which made it very difficult for my older sister, Brenda, because none of the guys wanted to come around to take her out, because Big Steve was always lurking. So the combination of having a very disciplined father. My mom was disciplined too, but her role was more of the love and, you know what, don't worry about dad giving you a whooping that's coming up for you not doing what you're supposed to do, because I'll be there to love you. So that combination of discipline and love went a long way, has gone a long way in my life.
Mm-hmm. Brent, you talked about your journey and, you know, it sort of brings us to your arrival on Princeton's campus. Now, at the time, I think you would have arrived in 1969, fall of 1969. Freshmen were not eligible to play. And, you know, for our listeners, you're a terrific player here at Princeton. You averaged 24 points over the course of your 3 years at Princeton. But if you could tell me about the getting recruited and choosing Princeton.
Yes. You know, I had a great guidance counselor at Perth Amboy by the name of Robert Estock. And during my summer year, he took a very close look at my grades, which were decent. You know, I was an A-minus student. And he said, you know, your writing's not that good. I have an opportunity for you to go to an enrichment program down at Lawrenceville. And he said, you're getting a lot of letters now. This is probably my sophomore year. I was still getting a lot of—I was starting to get a lot of letters from colleges all over the country, both in football and basketball. And he says, I see you as someone who could do well at an Ivy League institution, but in order for you to get admitted, you're going to have to do some enrichment.
Was that the first time someone had told you that?
Yes. And so I went down during the summer of my sophomore year in a six-week program at Lawrenceville Prep. It was a tremendous program. It was just two courses. One was a reading great books, and the other one was a writing course.
Do you remember who were the teachers in that enrichment course? Or,
I don't remember.
Somebody
the teachers.
Associated with
I just remember
the school.
The yeah. kids, which came from all over the country.
Mm.
I had some friends from New Orleans. I lost contact with them over the years, but boy, that was, we formed some special relationships with kids all over the country. And just getting that exposure, it was so much fun. I did it my sophomore, my junior summer as well. And looking back, if I didn't do that, I probably would never been able to get into Princeton, one, and two, survive when I got here, because my writing improved tremendously. And I even have some writing going back in the day before I did those courses, and it was just terrible. I was getting, you know, A's and B's, and my writing and reflection was pretty poor. And so I was lucky that I had somebody like Mr. Estock, who had the vision to see that I needed, you know, some additional support and enrichment, and to be able to go to a place like Lawrenceville. And, you know, you can go to Lawrenceville today, and it's beautiful, and the acreage and the buildings and just the whole facility is amazing. And so being so close to Princeton, I used to be able to come up to Princeton and see this fabulous and beautiful campus. But more than anything, my roommate was headed to Princeton the following year.
Hmm.
A guy by the name of Norman Townsend. He's a football player. And we became very, very close friends. So even during the course of my senior year, before I made a decision and before I was offered the opportunity to come to Princeton, I used to come and hang out with Norm during my senior year and fell in love with the place. Yeah. And then there was this little guy that used to show up to my games that I also fell in love with as a person.
This has got to be Coach Carrillo.
Yeah, that's Coach Carrillo. This guy was coming around with the stogie.
Right, he famously would walk into gyms with a lit stogie and coach practices with it. And so talk about Coach. You know, what was it like when you first met him? And then maybe talk about, you know, explain your relationship with Coach.
Yes.
First as a player.
Yes, as a player, it was more before playing for him, I built a relationship with Coach. And that the thing that attracted me to his appeal was that he was critical of me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you here you are getting recruited by hundreds of colleges around the country, and everyone's telling you how fabulous you are. And then Coach shows up and tells me what I have to work on to be a fabulous player. I like that. You know, I knew that I was going to get some great coaching from Coach Carrillo. And one of the things that always sticks out about Coach from my perspective is that he would say, you know, I wasn't coming to watch you play to recruit you. I was coming to watch you play because I enjoyed watching you play. Mm. And that really excited me. And then also my mother fell in love with Coach. You know, they used to love to hang out and drink beer. One thing I didn't do, Coach was like, you got to have some beer. You know, it's the best thing for
this
you.
This is a common thread.
Mom and Coach hit it off. They drink beer and just, you know, talk about life.
And what was specific about why you think your family connected with Coach so well?
Because he was honest. Mm. You know, he wasn't trying to sell me anything that wasn't real. He wasn't trying to do anything special for us. He's just a real person, and that's what we loved about Coach Carrillo. And then before early admissions became a part of Princeton, Coach said, if you want to go to Princeton, I'm going to try to get you early admissions. And if I got you early admissions, would you commit to going to Princeton? I was so excited to think that, oh, my God, I can remember that being such a nervous time for me because I wanted to come to Princeton so badly because of my relationship with Norm, for my relationship with my guidance counselor, Mr. Estock, who said, hey, Princeton is a fabulous place. You do well there. So I was excited just of the possibility of coming here. And when he told me that I got admitted, I was just overjoyed mm-hmm. that I would be going to Princeton. And it upset some people at Perth Amboy because these were the kids that were getting 4.5s and right. scoring 1600s on their college boards and didn't get the opportunity to come here or get admitted. But here I was, you know, a 90, maybe a 92 percenter and a basketball player. Also, I was the president of my class, which helped a lot.
You're no stranger to this sort of people thinking, you know, when you left after your junior year at Princeton, you know, there were lots of people that were like, hey, Brian, why don't you go and stick around? And so you're not a stranger to making these decisions that people around you maybe don't agree with.
Right.
And so as a student at Princeton, you know, you mentioned that, you know, now you look back and there was this valuable experience you had at Lawrenceville, you know, called the enrichment program, but what was it like at that time for you to be here knowing that, and it's not that different for a lot of students,
right.
knowing that you hadn't been given the same kind of tools maybe necessary as some of the other kids
right.
that go to school here, but also that you were playing basketball at a really high level. How did you balance it?
Discipline. You know, that's the tune that I preach right now. I guess it came from both my mom and my dad and my brother. Bruce is super disciplined, organized, such a hard worker. It's just I enjoyed spending time, an hour and a half every day of getting in the books, reading, you know, trying to improve my comprehension, and just knowing that I was going to put a two-hour block in to get some work done every day. Then I could go play. So the way the discipline worked for us at home was that you had to get your homework done before you were going to be able to go to the rec. So got used to carving that block of time for work every day and excited to get it done so I can go do what I really love, and that was to play baseball, play basketball, play some football, and hang out with my friends. Mm-hmm. So it just became a routine, and very difficult to continue that routine here at Princeton because the step up in terms of the rigor and the difficulty of the materials that I was reading made it for a more difficult challenge for me because that hour and a half wouldn't do anymore. It would be like more like 3 hours, and that's after participating in the Coach Carrillo workout.
How did you, after you made the decision and you're here, how did you, were you glad that you were getting exposed to that kind of a rigor?
Yes, I love the challenge. One of the books that had a great influence on me back in the day, a guy by the name of Jack Olson, had a series of articles in Sports Illustrated, and the title of the articles, which later became a book, was The Black Athlete, A Shameful Story. And I didn't want to be a shameful story. I wanted to be an educated young man. And so the discipline that was encouraged from my family continued when I was at Princeton, and it was difficult, but I knew in the back of my head if I was going to make something out of my life that and not be a shameful story, that I had to put the time and the effort and the hard work in to be a success. And so what made it more difficult here at Princeton, though, was the time I was here at Princeton. It was during the war revolt. Also, a lot of demonstrations from the African-American students that were on campus. So I was torn between whether I was going to be a revolutionary or an athlete. So while some of my friends were demonstrating and expecting me to be at the demonstration, I also had I had to be at practice. So which one was it going to be? So I gave my full support in terms of being behind the issues and, you know, fighting for what was right. But I knew in the back of my mind that I had committed to being a part of a fabulous basketball program, and that's where my heart and that's where my effort went. And so it made it difficult for making these decisions as to how where I was going to put my time at and my effort and my heart at. And so I think I was successful being able to bridge both gaps.
Yeah, and we've talked about this, but you've described some instances during games as a player at Princeton where, you know, discrimination was rampant, you know, from opposing teams.
Yes. Yes. Kentucky, of course. When we went down to Kentucky, you know, I heard a lot of racial slurs. I tore them apart, you know. I can remember that game. I was running through them like they weren't even there. Unfortunately, we didn't win that game. But I was inspired by some of the taunts. But it was nothing new. I got them in high school.
Yeah. John Berger tells a story. Sorry to interrupt you, but that, you know, you guys, Princeton was up 15 or 20. I'm not sure where this game was being played, but you were getting really people were going after you behind the basket. This was when dunking was illegal, and you came down and just hammered one home. Took the technical.
Yeah, I wish I had that one on film. I really do. I could remember. I was up there.
Yeah.
And it's like that. Yeah, in your face, you know. But I really was lucky because I had a lot of great guys that I played with and supported me.
Who were some of those guys?
Andy Rimmel. Andy Rimmel was our big center. Reggie Berry was a great backcourt partner, along with Ted Menakis, Bill Lee Kapler, another one of our centers, the late Bill Dake, who was an All-American from St. Louis who passed away, who was also a great talent for us. Another guy that passed away, who Alfred Burton, is a good friend of mine, who's a little bit younger, but he was also a great friend of mine on that team. Who else? I don't want to miss out anybody because I love that team. Al Duffy is also very Bill Sickler. I played with Billy Sickler on that team.
Well, you know, you've had a profound impact on all of these guys. I'm sure you know, it's hard for you to talk about it, but, you know, a lot of the guys that played on those teams talk about what it was like playing with you. And, you know, just so you know, one of Coach's great gifts, Coach Carrillo, was to bring together the history of the program and to the freshmen and sophomores coming into the program. And one of the staples of Princeton basketball, I always felt, was to show up to practice early and get yourself ready for practice.
Right.
You've talked about the discipline that you had, but you made it seem like it was an easy thing, and you implanted something in Coach Carrill's head that ruined it for the rest of us for a long time.
I'm sorry,
No, it's good. You were the only player that was allowed to show up 5 minutes before practice because you would show up and then kill everybody.
Yeah, that's because I needed the extra time in the classroom. Some of you guys were so smart, you didn't need the extra time in the classroom. But no, I loved the gym. I wasn't really a gym rat, so to speak. And I laugh at the guys today who talk about, oh, you got to get in the gym and take 500 to 1,000 shots. And my theory was that I come into the gym and I knock down 15 and 20 in a row, and I'm like, I'm sharp enough. I can leave now.
Right. I want to just touch on something. I want to read you a quote. This is from an article in 1983, New York Times. This is after you had come back to Princeton after playing professional basketball for 10 years. This is your quote. I see it differently. Going here, this is Princeton, made me humble. I'd be sitting in a cafeteria and think, the guy sitting next to me just invented a cure for a disease. This is in line with your thinking, and it probably never left you. And I want to get to your career, but what was it like after you had played, knowing that, and you left after your junior year and you were drafted to come back to Princeton?
That was
older.
Older, yeah. That decision to come back was one of the smartest decisions I made in my life. To be able to, at that time, I just had my first child, my wonderful daughter, Tabri. It's like 1 year old, and I had to make a decision to come back to New Jersey, come back home, and my wife and my daughter stayed in San Diego at the time.
Because you were with the San Diego Clippers.
I was just finished with I snapped my Achilles after 10 years, and the doctor said, hey, well, it's time to pick up the tennis racket because you're through. So no, it's time to pick up the books again. Yeah. And I came back. And
where did you live?
I lived in the first year I came back, because I had 3 semesters to do. I lived over at the OPIC,
Princeton
Inn.
College.
Yeah.
So you finished up your junior year.
I finished up the first semester.
And then one more year.
Yeah. And so when I came back, I lived over at PIC.
And that's now called Forbes College.
Is that Forbes College?
And that was my dorm.
That was your dorm?
My freshman, sophomore year. I loved it over there.
What was amazing about it was that my neighbors were women. And when I first chose to go to Princeton, it was the first year of co-education. So I come back 10 years later, and I'm sharing bathrooms with women. That blew my mind. There's still some of them are still my friends today. And so coming back was very special for me because I was like the old guru where people were attracted to. When I ate over at the PIC, I always had crowds around me.
Yeah.
They wanted to hear the stories, the NBA stories. And that was very, very special to me. And it was difficult. I mean, I remember some of the classes being very, very challenging. Up to the last day, I really wondered whether I was going to be able to graduate. I was a nervous wreck.
I bet you were better than you thought. Compare yourself freshman year 1969 fall to your return after, you're older, you're wiser, you've had a lot of experiences in life. As a student, what was the difference for you?
I think I was more focused as to what I was trying to accomplish as a student. Knowing that it was going to be a challenge for me when I left Princeton in 1972 to complete a thesis. I had...
What did you write your thesis on?
I wrote my thesis on black business and the challenge of... I think I titled it "The Black Business, the Real or Reality or an Illusion," and really focused on the governmental programs that were trying to support African-American entrepreneurs, whether it was really an illusion or whether it was a reality. I was taking a look at that. I had real interest in going into business when I left here, which I did, and took a real close look at some of the governmental support efforts to try to make black businesses more successful. and whether the support was really there or whether it was just an illusion. And so I couldn't have done that, I don't think, my senior year in 72, whereas coming back and doing that in 84, the experiences I had as an athlete and also as a businessman, an entrepreneur, made it a lot easier for me to complete a 75-page thesis, yeah. which was just average, to be honest with you. It was just an average piece of work. I remember my advisor saying, man, if you had more time, you could really make this an excellent piece of work. But you can imagine how challenging it was for me having a baby girl and a wife that were living in California, and I'm back here trying to focus on completing the thesis and working hard with, I think it was three other classes. Yeah. So it was just an average piece of work, to be honest with you. I could have made it really fabulous, but I did the best I could at that time.
You're of course, always modest, but at the time, the NBA, which you started off in the ABA, merges with the NBA in 1976. Is that about right?
Yes.
But only 55% of the players in the NBA actually had a bachelor's degree. So what you were doing going back and getting your degree was unusual. Yeah. Now it's a little bit more commonplace. In the NFL at the time, had even less, like 30% of the players in the NFL had a bachelor's degree. So I want to come back to this, but I've skipped over what a lot of us basketball junkies, and I've been dying to ask you these questions for many years, but. You started off with the New York Nets, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, you were originally drafted by the Sonics, but picked up by the Nets.
I could tell you a story about being drafted by the Sonics. That they knew that I had made, I don't know how they found out, but I had made a commitment to the New York Nets before the NBA draft.
So the Nets being in the ABA.
The Nets being the ABA.
And the Sonics. Now, was Dr. J with the Nets at that time?
No, Dr. J was with the Virginia Squires. He was one of the first guys, and I was right behind him, who chose to leave college to sign a professional contract before leaving college. So, interesting story. I wasn't really thinking about leaving Princeton in 1972. I remember one of the friends of the program told me that there were some people interested in meeting me in New York. And I'm like, oh, really? Who could that be? And I said, yes. Couple of Net executives would love to meet with you. I'm like, Net executives? For what? He says they want you to think about accepting an offer. I thought, okay, I'll meet with them. And I went by myself. I met with them in New York.
Where did you meet?
I tell a story, and people love this story. I met at the Waldorf Astoria. And it's a fabulous hotel, really ritzy hotel at the time. And I remember Coach Carnesecca. I'm meeting with Coach Carnesecca.
He was a coach of the Nets.
He was a coach of the Nets. And everyone knows that he's a Hall of Fame coach, primarily from his days coaching with St. John's. But at this time, he was the head coach for the New York Nets. So I go into the Waldorf Astoria. Of course, they have all the nice hors d'oeuvres, the big shrimp, big sweet. And the first question Coach asked me is like, how much money are you worth? How much money am I worth? I got maybe $3 to get back to Perth Amboy on the train. That's he said, well, we could change that overnight. I'm like, oh, God, you think I could think about writing a thesis after being offered what they offered me? They offered me a lot of money. Here I am at 20 years old. My mom works as a domestic. My dad works in the factory. You know, we're living in the projects.
Mm-hmm. And did you know?
I'm worth $3.
Yeah. What was that first contract?
First contract was, I don't like to be too specific, but it was six figures guaranteed over 4 years. I was offered, close to $1 million. And that's 1972. That's big money. But I got into my negotiating with the Nets was affected by an incident that happened with me on the train. Hmm. I was on my way to talk to someone who I really looked up to, is Bill Bradley. It was because this was a very unique time in history of sports. there was the ABA and the NBA, and there was a lot of discussion as to whether the two leagues were going to merge. And, of course, if they merged, the negotiating power wouldn't have been there because you would only be negotiating with one entity versus two. Mm-hmm. So I was really looking to talk to Bill about whether this was a good time to leave or should I stay and extend.
This is the spring of 72.
This is the spring of
72. And he would have been coming off an NBA championship.
Yes. And one of our friends who always gave me good tickets to go to the games, I can remember these tickets. They were like right behind the bench. And then they had arranged a meeting so I could talk to Bill about what was going on in the negotiations because he was, you know, in the leadership position in the NBA as a player rep and also one of the governing players. I never got there. I was stopped in Newark. And it was right after one of the coach's hard practices because we were on our way to – we had a disappointing second part of the season. I mean, we were ranked number 13 in the country at the beginning of the season. We beat North Carolina, Villanova. I think we were like 12-0 or 12-1. And then we went on that month break, and we came back. We lost four straight games. And then so you know what happened then? If we lost four straight games, coach is going to
– practices are longer.
Oh, and harder. So it was after one of these hard days of practice. I got on the train, the first seat on the train. Put my feet up because my knees were killing me, just stretched out, and the conductor came on the train and pointed at me, said, get your feet in the meanwhile, put your feet down. I'm like, oh, do I have to? But my knees are killing me. Yes, put those feet down. And I did. We get to Newark. He comes on the train with a couple of policemen, and he points at me, says, this one. And then he goes and points in the middle of the train at two other young African-American boys and said, these two. And so these guys came on the train, and the first thing they did is they put a claw in my shooting wrist. It's come with me. Oh, man, I can remember just talking about it now, the racial slurs that I had to hear putting me in a holding cell in Newark.
Oh, man.
And I'm like, what did I do? And so they put me in jail. I was in jail overnight. I think I got out the next morning. I had one call to make. I made a call to a good friend of mine, Mr. Harry Russell, who was a counselor to me to help me get out of jail. And this is all during that special season. So all of a sudden, I go from being a great role model to being, and I hate the word that they use a lot today, to a thug. And that was not Brian Taylor. I was just trying to be the opposite of that. You know, that image. And, of course, it was a false arrest, but it stayed with me. And, you know, that offer sort of, what they offered me sort of, you know, decreased. But it was still a great, you know, I still had to go. It was still a lot of money. I signed my first contract for a pretty attractive deal.
So, Brian, you know, you're talking about something that probably included a lot of pressure for you because at the time you are a figure that means a lot to a lot of other people. What was Coach Carrill's response? You know, here you are, you're falsely arrested on a train. Do you remember what you talked about with Coach Carrill then and his response to that moment?
I can remember Coach just being encouraging to me about the incident. Coach knew me very well, and he knew and had confidence in me that I wouldn't do anything to jeopardize all that we had built up. You got to remember, this is my junior year. I was here for 3 years. Coach knew me as a person. Not only did I spend time with Coach on the court back in the day, we used to bother Coach all the time over at his house and just to hang out. And so he knew me, and he knew that I was charged with, you know, threatening the life of the conductor. That's kind of hilarious, with an Afro pick. Because I had, back in the day, I had a nice little Afro, and I had that Afro pick in my pocket. And I'm like, what did I do? And so they trumped up some charges later on, saying that I threatened the conductor's life with an Afro pick.
What did your family say?
My family was couldn't believe that that I would do anything to jeopardize all that I had worked for. In reflection, and they all, both Coach and my family, had confidence that I didn't make a mistake in threatening anybody. That's just not who I am. So they were very, very supportive and encouraged, and I was just devastated. I was hurt, too. Mm-hmm. My wrist was, like, dangling, and I had to go and play. I think we had to play a couple days later. And so there was a little – I could see Coach being affected by what had all happened and the attention that incident got as right during our limelight. Mm-hmm. But he was very, very positive and encouraging. And it was a very difficult time because right after that I had to make a decision whether I was staying or whether I was going. Mm-hmm.
When you share this story with your family now, like what do you say to them?
What I say to them is, and I'm sure there's a lot of families throughout the country that are concerned about, I have two really tall and beautiful looking sons. And so what I say to them is that don't say anything. If you're stopped, mine is peculiar because not was I driving while black, as they say, driving while black. I was riding while black. So the lesson to them is this: hush up and listen and comply. I mean, in reflection, I could say that the mistake I made is I should have just put my feet down and say anything. Rather than even having a discussion about my knees hurting and I was tired, he didn't care about that. He just wanted me to put my feet down and that was it. And so the lesson I would teach my kids is if you're ordered to do something, just do it and button up your lip and just comply. And don't put yourself in a position that you will even be arrested or, you know, questioned on any wrongdoing. And I'm lucky. I have a great family, and my children have done very, very well. They're very conscious of how they carry themselves, and so. But we had this discussion just recently, and my son is Bryce, who plays in Germany. It's almost like I can't wait to get back to Germany because I don't even have to face the fear of being stopped and questioned just for, you know, who I am. Hmm. And so, in my younger son, who's 21 right now, same thing. You know, learn from my experience back in the day is that, and he drives. You know, he drives a fancy car, you know, and so you're putting yourself in a position that you're going to be stopped, and he has been stopped a couple of times with his friends in the car. And just listen and comply. Don't question the officer. And try to stay within the speed limit, which is difficult for the young folks. But, yeah, it's just it was a very, very difficult time for me. But I was supported by Coach Carrill and my family because they knew that was not my character.
Yeah. And not that – and today we've had – you know, we're taping this in the middle of July, and the last few weeks has been very...
This has been brutal.
Yeah.
All the way around. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about, this is 1972, and I wasn't even driving, I was riding on the train. Innocently, doing what I was supposed to be doing, had a great practice, tired going into the city, to meet with Bill Bradley, to discuss whether I should stay or leave. It was just the time. And didn't get there. Yeah. Didn't get there.
Yeah, wow.
And so I was really fortunate that just throughout my life, though, especially during the earlier times of my life, as I talked about a little bit earlier, is that I had that great support network. And a coach is one of the great people who've supported me all the way. I can remember I got thrown out of – they even used it during the trial, actually, it wasn't a trial. I sued them. The grand jury, it should have never got to the grand jury because they just said, there's nothing here. They still decided to take it to the grand jury. And the grand jury said, this dismiss this. Hmm. It's still on my record. As a matter of fact, when I found out about that, when they were doing a background check on me when I decided to work in Phoenix, with the charter school in Phoenix, I started work already. I got a phone call from the CEO saying, could you please call this number because they're not going to issue you a card.
Unbelievable.
I says, what? I'm squeaky clean. I'm surprised. So I called this officer who's in charge of background checks, and I said, I'm hearing that I have a record? I said, I don't understand. I've never been there. He says, yes, you have an FBI record. I said, I do? He says, yeah. Please call FBI because on the record they show that you were arrested back in 1971. Can you prove that you were not arrested? And I'm like, are you kidding me? I was falsely arrested in 1972 while riding on a train. And so I said, how am I going to fix this? So I went on the internet and I looked at an article, and it talked within the article how this was a false arrest. And I took a copy of it and sent it to them, and a week later I got my clearance card. And then just a couple days ago, I was talking to my sister about this. She says, wait a minute, when my mom passed, I went to her files, and I have some paperwork you need to see. And I said, please, let me see them. So I just read the other day how I had all my lawyer's records that talked about how the judge had dismissed all of these charges because it was a false arrest. Mm-hmm. Right. So I better go check with the FBI and make sure that that's still not on my record. But, yeah, it's very, very fortunate that I had a great coach like Pete Carrillo who understood me as a person. Yeah. And he just encouraged me to, you know, stay strong. And my parents were the same way. It was like, Brian, this it's unfortunate what happened, but just, you know, just be who you are and stay strong.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, welcome.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sure that being in the NBA or the ABA at the time, there were moments like this probably that happened to you throughout, right? Like, but being a professional basketball player, did that help to be able to be in that environment, and given the climate of the country, you know, we're right
yes.
now.
Yeah. So it's not a real world, though.
Yeah.
I mean, because the things that you are given, you're shielded for so much, and it's not really the real world. So our focus was not really so much on participating in changing the world as it is to win in the basketball game.
Yeah.
So
when you look at the contract that Kevin Durant signs or the current NBA crop of players, mm-hmm. like, what do you think about that?
I think about think how upset Oscar Robertson had to be when he realized that Brian Taylor was making more money than he was. It's just the evolution of the game. And especially now when I look at the type of money that the guys are getting, it's per agreement with the NBA. I mean, the NBA just signed a $24 billion deal, TV contract. And per their negotiating agreement with the players are going to share in close to half of the revenues. So it's just part of being in the free enterprise system. And I couldn't get upset with those guys for the kind of money that they're making because I know we all wonder whether that guy's being overpaid or not, but I'm thinking they better spend it before they take it back. No, it's just the evolution of the game. Like, can you imagine Oscar Robertson being the best guy in the game, and all of a sudden here's a guy who's unproven, comes into the league, and he's making more money than he is.
Yeah.
And so it's just the way, you know, the system works. And so people always say that, oh, you know, you were like 30 years, or, you know, actually more than 30 years too late. And I'm like, hey, I guess the guys that were before me were thinking the same thing when we came in and changed the economics of the game. And there's no question about it that being a pioneer in changing the economics of the game. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, it's just the evolution of how it
grown. You talk about being a pioneer, Brian. You know, I wanted to just, and, you know, most people don't know this about you, but in 1975-76, the ABA, and if I have this right, started a three-point line.
Well, the three-point line was in effect right from the beginning in the ABA.
Okay.
Yes.
And you weren't taking a lot of threes. Now, you did – Coach Carroll always loved the outside shot, but you weren't taking a lot of threes when you first got there. But you made 90 threes. You were – if I have it right here, I think you attempted close to 239 three-point shots. And that was a record that stood for almost 10 to 15 years.
Yes.
And you talked about was it Coach Shue?
Coach Gene Shue.
Yeah, it was way ahead of his time.
He's way ahead of his time, and believe it or not, I didn't like that shot. Because I was not taught that. It's not, at the time, it really wasn't a good percentage shot. I didn't shoot it the first couple years in the ABA because I was used to shooting
high percentage
and good shots that Coach taught me were good shots. And, you know, when I didn't take a good shot at Princeton, you know, I heard about it. He encouraged me to shoot, but they had to be good percentage shots. So going into the ABA, I didn't take that shot because I looked at it as not being really a good percentage shot. And so I think it was around my fourth year in the ABA, I started taking more of those and making more. And if I can recall, I shot my last year, 75-76, I shot over 40%.
Oh, 42% from three. That's
pretty impressive.
Very.
Even to this day. And then the league thought it was just a gimmick shot. So they didn't adopt it to, maybe 3 years later. And when they did adopt it, I was lucky to have a coach who believed in it, and that was Coach Gene Shue. Mm-hmm. So he had designed plays for most of the guards on the Clippers to shoot that shot. But since I was coming off demonstrating that I was a good percentage shooter with that shot, I shot a ton of them off a design play. You know, the low post, Coach's old low post play that he stole from the Boston Celtics, beginning of the Princeton offense. And he'll tell you to this day, he laughs when they said the Princeton offense because you know how much he loved the Celtics, and it was the old low post play.
Yeah.
You dump it in down low, and you move off of that. Well, instead of moving to set the screen on the top of the key to have the X action off it, my guy would always turn his head to go double down on Bill Walton early on, and then Sven Nader. I would sneak to the corner, and he was unselfish enough to pop it to me, and I catch and shoot it. Easy shot from
right,
the
you
corner.
Mentioned Sven Nader, famously Bill Walton's backup at UCLA, and then becomes his backup with the Clippers. But he was a really good player. He almost averaged, shot him over 50% from the field, and a very good Princeton-type center.
Right. He would have been great at Princeton for sure. Also, he worked very hard on his low-post move with the great Pete Newell. Hmm. He went to his camps, and he developed this unbelievable spin move. So even though Bill went down, we had Swin as his backup, and people respected his percentage shot inside, so they would always double down on him. So I made a living off great guys like Bill Walton and Sven Nader, and, of course, Dr. J, where the guys would leave me wide open. They would go double Doc all the time, and Doc was so unselfish. I would just spot up, catch and shoot it. And it was the same thing with Sven Nader and Bill Walton, just knowing how to move without the ball, which is one of the things that Coach taught me when I came to Princeton. He says, don't go to the ball, yo. Don't bring trouble to the ball. Okay, I had to learn how to move without the ball, and boy, did we move without the ball beautifully with Teddy being able to pass that ball off the dribble, and that the beginning of that Princeton offense was a sight to see.
Well, you're a good passer yourself. I mean,
well, I didn't want to pass, right? Coach made me, he made me hit the open man, but it's something that I developed over time, just being able to be unselfish and pass, hit the open man on easier shot. I could remember Coach teaching me how to do that pass off the dribble without bringing your second hand. That little hole there. So, I mean, we worked on that little pass off the dribble.
I remember the first time he did that with me.
Yeah.
Too. Can you, simple can you try
stuff.
It like this? You know,
right.
Try not putting your hand on the ball.
Yeah.
So I teach today.
Yes.
You have a nickname in the NBA, BT Express. Who gave you that?
BT Express is a nickname that came from the ABA days. Of course, everybody in the ABA had a nickname. And since I was so fast, Dr. J gave me that name because there was a group at the time called the BT Express, and they had this disco music. And it was a train, that fast train coming at you. So, you know, Doc had his nickname, Dr. J, and then all of a sudden he says, you got to have a nickname, BT Express. And so it was so exciting during that time, Coach, because they used to play that music, and here comes the Express, right before they would introduce me, and it would psych me up. But, yeah, BT Express.
Yeah, Dr. J. Tell me about Dr. J.
Oh, Dr. J is somebody who is such a fantastic human being. I could remember playing with him throughout my years and never really seeing him get upset enough to yell at his teammates. I mean, he's just always talked to us. He encouraged us. Talk about, back to that word, leadership, a true leader, inspirational leader that made his teammates better. And, you know, I'm really excited that he says to this day that, you know, we're joined at the hip, because the 3 years that we played together, the two championships that we had the joy to share with each other, is something that is very, very special in both of our lives. And when we get together these days, we all always reminisce about the great ABA days, where people thought we were second-class basketball players. But when the two leagues merged, we showed them a new game. It's mm-hmm. a fast-breaking game, you know, free to shoot the three-pointer above the rim.
Yeah. What was he like as a player? I mean, of course, we all know before, you know, Michael Magic came on the scene, you know, it was Dr. J.
Yeah.
And describe him as a player.
Great passer. People always criticize him for not being a great shooter, but that was something that he worked on. And guess what? He became a clutch outside shooter in terms of excitement to the game, unmatched. I mean, I would just love to get the ball to him and to the wing and watch. And it's funny, I see a lot of pictures of us together. Now there's a picture, a famous picture of him on the Sports Illustrated. I think it was the first time that they put it, an ABA folder on the cover of Sports Illustrated. And there I am at the free throw line with my hands on the hip watching Doc do his thing. And I always tease him. I said, they always cut out the guy that passed you the ball. He said, don't worry about it, B. We're just joining at the hip. So his basketball ability was underrated in some facets of the game. He's also a tremendous defensive player. Could block shots with his long arms. He could get out and deny on the wings. Strong enough to give guys trouble in the post. Just a fabulous all-around basketball player.
Now, hearing you talk, you know, you once were quoted again around the same time as when you came back to Princeton. You said, finish the sentence, Princeton basketball is, and you said, the epitome of teaching one person how to use his individuality to prosper the group. And as you talk, you're really describing the modern game, too, the way the teams are playing now. You talk about Dr. J's passing, your passing, you know, playing like a team.
Right.
You look at the best teams right now in the NBA, you've got a trend in players wanting to be on a team.
Yes.
Where the ball gets shared.
That's a good thing. And, of course, everyone's criticizing Durant for making that decision to play with
the
Warriors.
What do you think about that?
And, of course, I look at it from both sides. I told my sons, I said, well, where would you rather live, in OKC or the Bay Area? And they're like, no, you're missing the point, Dad. You're missing the point. And so, of course, I made the tough decisions in my life, made the tough decision to leave Princeton. I made a tough decision to leave Denver over some controversial things. But it was his decision. I respect his decision, and it comes back down to how do you play? When you look at OKC, did they play as a team? Was the ball moving? That's not a fun way to play. Mm-hmm. I'm watching Westbrook, and you got to wonder if I'm open, am I going to get the ball? Or do I go and play with a team where there's a beauty to the way they play? Is the movement, you know, there's the unselfishness of the players. That's going to be a lot of fun. Fun for him to play in a system like that.
Yeah.
So people can't see it from that perspective, but just how much happier he's going to be knowing that I don't have to score 30 every game in order for us to be successful. There might be some games where I might get 15, play good defense, pick up a steal here, do some rebounding, and we come out being successful, and that's no pressure on me.
Mm-hmm.
We won the game, and we played the right way. So I could see why he would make a decision to go and play with a team like Golden State, because they pass the ball and they move the ball like a Princeton system. You know what I mean, Coach?
Yeah. Hey, I like the fact that you just made a connection to us and the Warriors. I'm not going to stop you. But I could talk about this all day, but I want to talk about life after basketball, really. You know, you came back, you're a political science and African-American studies major here at Princeton. You ended up, you're technically a 1985 graduate of the university, and you've really dedicated the last few years here of your life, the last 30 years, to education.
Yes.
And to giving back. And, you were at Harvard-Westlake for 10 years.
Yes, I was at Harvard-Westlake for 10 years, and guess how I got to Harvard-Westlake for 10 years? It was the Princeton connection. Mm. The headmaster, Mr. Thomas Hudnott, who I owe a lot to as I was transitioning out of business. I went into business for 10 years after leaving Princeton. I was really using my thesis whether, black business could be successful with support from the government to start a computer company. It was called Computer Intelligence, and it was an integration program where we added software to IBM systems, and I was one of the first value-added dealers to IBM, and that grew old after a while. I knew that I wanted to coach. I knew I wanted to teach, and I was beginning to expand my family. So I thought, what could I do that my family would be most proud of me? And I said, this is a no-brainer for me. I got to become an educator. Mm-hmm. So they could be very, very proud of me giving back and sort of leading the way in the value of education. As you asked me, who influenced this focus on education, and I say it was the whole community, it was my whole family, and it's the same thing. I wanted to be able to make an impression on my family, as I have five kids, about the value of education. There was no better way to do that than getting involved in education. So when I had the opportunity to become an administrator, a coach, and a teacher at Harvard-Westlake, it was a no-brainer for me. It was one of the best private schools in the country. And I got to do everything that I love to do. I wanted to coach basketball. I wanted to teach computer science. And I wanted to use my public relations. And so I became one of the directors of admissions to change the look of Harvard-Westlake, which was a predominantly Anglo school. And so Tom asked me to come in and try to bring some diversity.
How did you do that?
Just getting out into the community. Rubbing elbows, meeting people, talking about education.
I would imagine a lot of people would be very attracted to your story.
Yes, and it changed the look of Harvard-Westlake. My kids went there, got a tremendous education. As a matter of fact, I was talking to Bryce, who's my oldest son, the other day, and he was like, Dad, the friends that I was able to develop at Harvard-Westlake are some of my best friends to this day. And, I want to thank you for what you've given me in just that regard. And that really, brought chills
to me. Some powerful words.
And so, leading the way in education. So I enjoy my 10 years at Harvard-Westlake, changing the look of this private institution, which a lot of kids otherwise wouldn't have the opportunity to be involved with because of the economics of that place. I mean, it's probably $40,000 to this day just to go to that private institution. And so, my older daughter went there. She got a volleyball scholarship to UC Irvine, played on two state championship teams in volleyball. So it was very, very special for our family. But a friend of mine from New Jersey, who's also a basketball coach and an English teacher, said, Brian, let's take this model and bring it into the inner cities. I like that idea, but, I'm sort of committed to here. My son still has another year to go here, and, I'll help you. So I became a founding trustee at the time we called it the Inner City Educational Foundation, which was a mistake because everyone thought that we were giving money when we needed money by just naming it that. We learned that later on, but so after Bryce graduated from Harvard-Westlake, I got a call from a guy by the name of Michael Piskel. And he said, listen, B, I got your school. I mean, what do you mean you got my school? We had already started the elementary school and very, very successful. And then we were awarded our second school, which was a middle school. He says, I don't know anybody in the country that has many years of your experience working with middle schoolers, because that's what I did at Harvard Westlake, than you. I need you to come over and direct it. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, okay, Bryce is leaving. When Bryce leaves, I'll come over and direct it. So I went over and directed the middle school. We were so successful that we started the high school. That was three schools. We were so successful at the high school, all of a sudden, within 7-8 years, we had 15 schools serving 4,000 kids in the inner cities using that Harvard-Westlake rigor model, reading great books.
Let's get into that. Describe your approach, your style. What is it that makes you successful? And then, because there's always, in my experience, there's always a person behind these schools, right? Like there's the curriculum, there's the core.
Right.
You've taken this model in so many different places, but what is it? What is it about your
interpersonal
approach?
Skills. It begins with interpersonal skills.
And how?
And so what I use is as a hook is basketball. I hook the kids.
With non-athletes.
You connect in some fashion. You look at what you have in common, and that's how you connect. It may not be basketball. You know, it may be, it may be fashion. Hmm. Whatever it is, I choose to connect with them on that level and use that as a hook to build a relationship. And then after that, you talk about the value of education and what it takes in order to be a success in life. Mm-hmm. And you build the trust, become the skills that I think I've developed to help me in that arena, and hopefully it will help me as I move into the next phase of my life, is just being a good listener. Mm-hmm. People don't realize listening is a skill. So you develop that good listening skills, and you know what you need to offer that child in order to inspire them, in order to motivate them, in order to connect with them, in order to love them. So I think the reason we became very successful is people wanted to come to these schools because they knew they were going to get a lot of love, mm-hmm. and that we were going to try to serve the whole child. And it just, the kids would come, and the kids would want a hug. And, when you had the discipline, that's always been the toughest part of my job, is because they would think that because I'm giving them this unconditional love, that there was not going to be any discipline to go with it. But the key on the discipline side is that you listen. I'm not going to give you what you want, but I'm going to give you the opportunity to hear your side of the story, which I always say there's three sides of the story. There's coach's side, there's Brian's side, and then there's the truth. And then as a director or as a principal, you're the sheriff that has to decide what the truth is. And you do it with a lot of compassion.
Are there any kids that stand out, that anybody that pops out?
In terms of...
The personal touch and, over time.
I can't say any one individual child, but I have several pictures of me with a bunch of kids that are all just dying to get around me in the picture, because it zooms love, and that's something very, that's something very, very special to me, is that how I'm able to, and I was that way as a young athlete, and even before my time at in the pros, I have records of me working with young children. Actually, that was the job I did. It was called Summer in the Cities. During my time at Princeton, the job I had is that I would they would support a program that I had at Perth Amboy, where I would go back and work in basketball and baseball, and also we had a reading program.
This was sponsored by Princeton.
This was sponsored by Princeton. They allowed me to go back to Perth Amboy and work in the inner cities, and I always worked with the youth, mm-hmm. and enjoyed it and loved it.
So we're sort of too present here now, because you've transitioned back from the West Coast, and we're lucky to have you back. And we've been seeing a lot more of you here recently.
Yes.
You're back.
I'm
home.
Enjoying it.
Yeah, walk me through what's been going on here lately.
Yes, it's very interesting how I decided to come back and put some time into working with young people from my hometown in Middlesex County, and probably it will be a lot of young people throughout New Jersey. Is that I was working on a program in California to develop some athletes who want to become pros. And a circumstance happened where one of the individuals that I was working with got into a little trouble, and it was almost like ordained from God that, you know what, it's time for you to move in a different direction. I'm very passionate about working with young people in basketball. I love to share with them what I've learned. And, of course, I think a lot about coach in my teaching kids how to play the game the right way, and that's working on the fundamentals. And that brings a lot of joy to me. So about 3 months ago, I got a phone call. Actually, through social media, I got a contact, a message from a young man that I touched a long time ago. He says, I'm going to be in your area. Can I have coffee with you? I said, sure, I'll meet with you. And then he explained to me when he was a little kid how he met me, and I had some encouraging words to him, and I motivated him. He says, guess what? I went on to be a success at Perth Amboy High School. We didn't win a championship, but we were close like you. And I always remember the words that you inspired me with, and you'd be very proud of me. I developed a club team in Perth Amboy that has close to 100 kids, and I need your help.
Wow.
And I said, well, I'm coming back to, you know, I'm coming back to
you
Princeton.
Were just knowing, you know, this was, you were beaming inside.
I was like, ooh. So I said, you know, I'll work with some of your kids when I come back. I'll do a couple clinics with them because I'm heading back to reunions and, you know, I'll work with you. And I was working with the kids and loving it. You know, working on just Princeton backdoor cut off the dribble. This is the stuff we know, coach. And a friend of mine who played on the best football team that we ever had at Perth Amboy, a guy by the name of Alan Goldsmith, came up to me while I was doing this, and he said, you know what? I'd like to offer you to become a goodwill ambassador to my organizations. And he runs the Jewish Renaissance Foundation out of Perth Amboy. He's done an unbelievable job. He's got like an $18 million medical center in Perth Amboy that serves over 40,000 low-income families and getting them all the social services that they need. He's done unbelievable things and within the school system. He has a school program within the system. Also, he's in 10 different countries. He says, we're close to getting the ability to give you an ambassadorship to the United Nations as a goodwill ambassador using basketball as what you love, as the hook for humanitarian around the world. I'm like, are you serious? He says, yes. I think you have an unbelievable impact. Coming back here. So it was a no-brainer for me. Mm-hmm. My kids are all grown up and running. Bryce will be in Germany. My youngest son's going to be in Oregon. Mm-hmm. He's working on his master's. He's going to play for the great Luke Jackson School in Oregon in his last year. My daughter's in Phoenix. My other daughter's. I'm like, I've done my job. Mm-hmm. The kids are grown. Now it's time for. I was thinking, yeah, I'm 65, don't tell anybody, but I'm telling everybody, it's time to retire. I'm like, no, it's time to do what I always dreamed of doing. I started the organization with Mike to build the Inner City Educational Foundation. I went to Phoenix to work with that charter school and do that. It's like, I've always wanted to have a leadership institute where we learn from the great coaches that I was fortunate enough to play under and the great players, read their books, teach the kids about comprehension, teaching them about the great writing model. It's time for me to do that. Mm-hmm. And so Perth Amboy said, oh, we would love for you to do that at Perth Amboy. And, of course, we were talking about some of the guys that you have. We'd love to do a mentorship program with our guys. And so we're going to do we're in the stages
they would love that, yeah.
Doing the pen pal situation, mm-hmm. Helping the kids with their writing. So, like, this is where I belong. Mm-hmm. And Jersey's home, of course, Perth Amboy. My sister still lives in Perth Amboy. And so I'm very, very excited about the next phase of doing some pioneering.
Yeah, I would safe to say that we all feel that way. We're really glad to have you back home. And I want to wrap up with any Coach Carrill stories that you might want to share?
Well, Coach Carrill stories that I like to share is that leaving Princeton, I know it was very upsetting to a lot of people after my junior year. And I know I disappointed Coach a lot on that. And I probably had a couple things to try to justify me leaving. I remember saying they didn't want to give me the program that I was working on, Summers in the Cities. They had cut that off, and I had some things to say that, you know, I would take back to this day. But the thing about Coach is that, you know, he forgave me. And, you know, our relationship today is one is, you know, I look at him as a second father. And then the stories I would say about Coach is that he treated me just like he treated everybody else. I could just remember Coach always on my butt about getting my passes deflected. And he'd blow that whistle, stop in the middle of the top of the key, and he's like, damn it, Ryan, how many times I got to tell you, you got to fake one to make one. So I could just remember now, here I am, old as can be, you know, ancient, and still having nightmares of faking one to make one. But I learned, I listened, because I became a really good passer when I went to the pros, because I was faking one to make one.
He tells the story about when you came back and, you know, you were rehabbing after your Achilles.
Right.
You would play noon hoops. And Coach loved the set shot.
Oh, he's out there.
He'd love to take the long
shot.
He was
out there. And so, but that makes me think about my brother, who's always, Brian, you're such a gunner. I said, no. I learned how to hit the boards playing with Coach Carrillo, because that shot was going to be missing sometimes, and I was there knowing how to tip that sucker in.
I'll be sure to tell him. Well, Brian, I am so thankful that we get a chance to, you know, to visit together. And, you know, I know that we're looking forward to having you around and having you be a part of not only our students' lives, our current students' lives,
right.
but also, you know, I think the people of Perth Amboy are very excited, too, to have you back.
So well, thank you so much for having me today and allowing me to share some of the stories that I haven't told people. But this is me, and I appreciate you giving me this opportunity, Coach. Look forward to watching you guys this year, being closer to home.
Well, we want to have you around. You know, I want to be able to point over and say, you see that guy over there? That's the BT Express. You know what that means? You know. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Coach.